From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
If the feds drop tax credits connected to Obamacare coverage, millions of Floridians may be facing higher health care costs.
If this goes away, you're going to see an increased cost in your health insurance.
Also this week, if you want to spark a big controversy, just propose a black bear hunt in Florida.
This is not like a run and gun, and you know, we make decisions based upon science.
Talk to a lot of hunters. To a person, every one of them opposes this hunt.
We'll also hear from military veterans who oppose the death penalty, and we'll take a deep dive with some of Florida's original mermaids. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end of week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida is a deeply Republican state. It's predominantly conservative politically. But it's also a place where the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, is incredibly popular. A tax credit that allows more people to affordably access Obamacare is set to expire. As Tristan Wood reports, that could place a big burden on many policyholders.
That would just crush my world. It's like, do I get my prescription meds or do I go to my doctor's appointment?
Millette Haas, a Florida resident going through cancer treatment, benefits from the federal Affordable Care Act tax credits.
Those tax credits saved me total $3,000 out of pocket I don't have to pay, and I'm on a fixed income.
Almost 5 million Floridians are enrolled in the ACA, the most out of any state in the country. Scott Darius, executive director of Florida Voices for Health, says the tax credits help over 2 million middle-class Floridians afford insurance.
For people making between 100 and 400%, what we would generally consider as middle class, for those folks to be able to afford coverage based on some of the premiums that we were seeing, and you know, the fact that these folks are earning a very specific amount between $15,000 and $25,000, right, depending on like your family size, those tax credits were assistance to help pay for your monthly premiums and other out-of-pocket costs.
Florida Voices for Health isn't the only group pushing for the tax credit renewal. Florida Conservatives for Affordable Health Care also wants them to stay in place.
And when I was in D.C. lobbying, we opposed Obamacare. However, this is a portion of Obamacare that I think the Affordable Care Act, that is working.
That's Brewster Beavis, president and CEO of Associated Industries of Florida. He says the credits help keep many Florida workers who make too much to qualify for Medicaid on health insurance. If the enhanced credits aren't renewed, he thinks rising costs could mean some people won't be able to afford their plans.
Your health care right now is where it's at. Your premium is where it's at because of this. If this goes away, you're going to see an increased cost in your health insurance. And, you know, I think one of the fears for us and others is they're not going to sit there and blame the federal government because they don't know they're on it. They're going to probably blame potentially their health plan of, oh, you greedy health plans are increasing your costs. Well, that's not the case.
With the enhanced tax credit set to expire, healthcare companies operating in Florida have already announced projected rate increases. Those increases range from 40% to 8.73%. In their justification documents, the credits not being renewed is frequently cited as a reason for the rate hike. But it won't just impact individuals, but also Florida's hospital system. Mary Mayhew, president and CEO of the Florida Hospital Association, says programs like the tax credits are important for Florida hospitals too. She's urging lawmakers to view the tax credits through a pro-business lens.
How do you help individuals stay employed, be able to afford commercial health insurance that also reimburses healthcare providers at commercial health insurance rates? That is far above what providers like hospitals and physicians get from Medicaid or even Medicare.
And Millette Haas says politicians in Congress should recognize that letting the credits expire would negatively impact their constituents.
Because you're impacting the middle class and all these people that are on healthcare.gov, they're on there because they need help.
But Scott Darius isn't optimistic Congress will follow the urging of his and other groups.
It feels like the likeliest vehicle to have gotten this done would have been the One Big Beautiful Bill, but it didn't. And so While there are rumblings, I'm not terribly optimistic that this is something that'll happen before the end of the year.
I'm Tristan Wood.
A bear hunt is set to take place this December, the first in Florida in about a decade. The State Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission gave final approval for the plan at a meeting this week. But as Margie Menzel reports, many environmentalists say they're concerned about what the hunt could mean for the state's black bear population.
There were so many people at the hearing that there were two overflow rooms. The attendees' affiliations were usually clear from their T-shirts, such as the Sierra Club or the North Central Florida Dog Hunters Association. Community leaders and members of the public took to the mic to share their views.
Bears belong in their natural habitat, and encounters should be the exception, not the norm.
Gulf County Commissioner Sandy Quinn says increased bear sightings have alarmed county residents.
That's why Gulf County supports FWC's recommendations for a regulated bear hunt and for proposed methods of take.
That's a view David Avant, a lifelong hunter who lives in Gadsden County, shares. He says he thinks the question of bear hunting shouldn't be open to public comment at all.
It should be based on biology and not heartstrings.
Avant says he'd like to see bear hunting enshrined in the state constitution.
Bears are causing us problems. We're going to solve them if you can't. So we stand our ground here in Gadsden County, and I appreciate your time. Let us hunt them with dogs like we always have for the last 200 years. It's our family's tradition.
The final rules include a bag limit of one bear per permit, with 187 permits issued this year. They allow bears to be killed near game feeding stations on private lands. Starting in 2027, the rules will allow dogs to be used. Commission staffers say a phased-in approach will provide time to train the dogs. But cattle rancher Lauren Jurgensen says while she's been a longtime hunter, she has concerns about the plans for this hunt. She attended a landowners meeting over the weekend.
Talked to a lot of hunters. To a person, every one of them opposes this hunt. I want you to know that.
Kate McFall, with the group Humane World for Animals, worries that the use of dogs and some of the other proposed hunting methods could cause bears to die slower, more painful deaths. She urged commissioners during the meeting to rethink those plans.
If you do proceed today with this proposal, please, please remove the cruelest practices, hounding, baiting, and archery. It's much harder to take them away later.
McFall wasn't alone in her concerns about rules that will allow hunting with bows and arrows and, in the future, hunting with dogs. It was a frequent point made by hunt opponents during the meeting. FWC Chair Rodney Barreto didn't directly address those criticisms, but he says he thinks the agency's process for developing its rules was a careful one.
I want the public to know that this is not like a run and gun, and, you know, we make decisions based upon science. We look at our professional staff. Look at our professional staff with over 100-something years of professionalism right here.
The Wildlife Commission voted unanimously in favor of the hunting plan. The first hunt will start on December 6th and last 23 days. Hunts are slated to recur every year. I'm Margie Menzel.
Governor Ron DeSantis has authorized a new immigration detention center at the former Baker County Correctional Institution. He calls it Deportation Depot. The governor says it's being prepped to house up to 1,300 detainees.
You talk about ready-made infrastructure. This was something that was very appealing from that perspective because it would require us to do a lot less in standing up than we would at Blanding and far less than we had to do at Alligator Alcatraz.
The governor initially proposed using part of Camp Blanding in Clay County as the state's second detention facility after opening Alligator Alcatraz in the Everglades, but he says the Baker County facility will cost much less to operate. The prison was shut down in 2021 due to statewide shortage of correctional staff. Coming up on Capitol Report, Military vets asked Governor DeSantis to revisit the death penalty cases of their fellow vets who've been traumatized by their service.
The veterans who are among the most profoundly mentally injured by the experiences of modern war.
A Florida Public Media member talks about what recent federal and state budget cuts will mean for his operation and many others around the state.
We now have to look at the spreadsheet, see how much each program costs us, and then determine whether we'll keep it.
We'll find out why Tampa has been named the best U.S. city for international business.
Less reliant on global trade and then thus less exposed to disruption.
And we'll meet some of Florida's original official marine mammals. The state of Florida has an execution planned for Tuesday, August 19th. That will make 11 so far this year, an all-time record for the state. The man set to die on the 19th is 67-year-old Cale Bates. He was convicted of the 1982 abduction and murder of Janet White in Bay County. For decades, Bates has been represented by attorney Tom Dunn. Oh, and like Bates, Dunn is a military veteran.
Absent intervention by the courts, Kyle will be the 10th person and the 4th veteran executed by Governor DeSantis this year.
Dunn and several other veterans, all opposed to the death penalty, have been lobbying Governor DeSantis to grant clemency to vets on death row. Here's Bill Kissinger, a Vietnam vet and criminal justice reform advocate.
It's time to stop executions for everyone, but most especially for our most vulnerable. Our most vulnerable are our veterans.
National figures show military vets are 3 times as likely to be arrested as the general population, and ongoing behavioral issues often lead to violence, which can turn deadly. Veteran Davey Ferrieri has some insights about the service-related trauma behind so many of these cases.
A lot of these guys exist looking to replace the chaos that they experience as young men. And we now have a collective title called post-traumatic stress disorder.
Art Cody is a former Navy captain who directs the Center of Veteran Criminal Advocacy.
The veterans who are among the most profoundly mentally injured by the experiences of modern war are seemingly being singled out for execution. Florida is preparing to execute its 4th veteran of this year.
And Cody says all the veteran advocates are asking is for the state of Florida, along with all states that have the death penalty, to look more deeply into each individual case involving a veteran offender.
The increasing frequency with which combat veterans have been condemned and executed evidences the need for corresponding scrutiny of the circumstances that brought them into contact with the criminal justice system and eventually to execution.
Amid state and federal funding cuts to public media, the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast went on the road to the 2025 Florida Media Conference. It featured editors and publishers discussing the state of the state in journalism. Sergio Bustos, vice president for news at WLRN in Miami, visited the podcast to talk about how public media stations like his highlight the experiences of people living in their communities. Here's an excerpt.
You've got quite a bit of news going on down there.
Yeah, usually we're covering news. Now we're the news subject.
You are both.
Yes.
I mean, you're covering and the subject. But talk about, I heard you talking a little bit about this during one of the panel discussions yesterday. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Yeah, you know, as journalists, we like to just get to the point, get the numbers, and here are the numbers. With the Rescission Act by Congress, coupled with Governor Ron DeSantis's veto of state funding for public radio and public TV, mm-hmm. we're taking about a $2 million hit at WLRN. We have a budget of $14 million, so $2 million is significant. And the $2 million came from through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in terms of federal dollars. And then we took a $500,000 hit from the state when, again, DeSantis vetoed public funding for public radio and public TV in Florida.
Give us a little bit of context. What does that mean for you? Now, I'm a member of my local public radio station up in Tallahassee, WFSU. Love them. What does that mean? When they do the fundraising drives, they often tell you, you know, some of the shows that we like to listen to, Fresh Air, things like that, they cost X number of dollars per year. But functionally, tell us what a $2 million cut to your budget means in terms of what coverage, what program, how that affects programming.
No, it's a good question because this is where I think there's been a little confusion. NPR itself, National Public Radio, says they're taking a 1%. They get 1% of their funding from the CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, with the elimination of this agency and the disappearance of all funding, NPR is not going to take just a 1% hit because they also rely on programming fees. They charge all the member radio stations for programming.
Right.
So for us, I think we pay NPR about 1.2 to 1.5 million a year for All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Weekend Edition. I think Fresh Air is also part of that lineup.
Right.
So these are shows that are, I mean, to be perfectly blunt, we now have to look at the spreadsheet, see how much each program costs us, and then determine whether we'll keep it. In our case, we do have a reserve fund that'll help us, so we don't expect to cut anything because at the end of the day, these shows are also why audience tune us in.
And like me, why we donate, right?
Correct. It's a bit of a catch-22. We could save money if we cut back in programming, but then we'd have to create our own programming, which would actually be more costly and maybe not as popular because Fresh Air, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, already have brand name recognition with our audience.
Is there a concern that if you don't provide this programming, now you say you're not going to make any programming changes, but maybe for other stations, they have to cut back. So they do away with that particular show, say Fresh Air, just for example, I'm imagining that's one of the pricier ones. Then, you know, the problem could be you lose listenership because a lot of stations are now available online. I mean, I listen streaming. We listened to WFSU streaming all the way down in the 7-hour trip from Tallahassee to Port Charlotte the other day. So is there a concern that you might lose listeners that way? Or am I giving people a good idea that I should shut up about?
No, we don't want you to shut up. No, I mean, it's better to be transparent and talk about all this.
Yeah.
But for us, again, we'll dig into some reserves and try to cover the gap. We've been very fortunate that our funding drive, we stepped up with all the talk in Washington mm-hmm. and Tallahassee about funding cuts. And our donors, our regular listeners, have stepped up immensely. We've gotten several hundred thousand dollars to make up for the shortfall. The problem is not just this year, but looking forward.
So it's not sustainable.
Right.
Or is it sustainable, I guess, is the question.
Well,
I mean, how many bake sales can you have keep running a radio station?
Right. Ideally, you want to keep that government funding. But to answer your other question, again, we may not cut, but some other stations,
right,
smaller ones around the state of Florida even, may even consider going off the air.
That was WLRN's Sergio Bustos on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Tampa has been named the best U.S. city for foreign businesses. The Financial Times and Nikkei ranked the city based on things like falling utility costs and a major reduction in crime. But WUSF's Lily Belcher found Tampa's resilience to trade issues is the main reason for the win.
Being from Tampa, or being from Florida, adds a lot to who we are.
Roy Levy is the U.S. general manager for an Israeli-based drone company called Extend. It opened its U.S. headquarters in Tampa in June. One of his pilots powers up an indoor drone in their warehouse just off Hillsborough Avenue.
3, 2, 1.
This drone is called the Extender. The U.S. military could use it to scope out the insides of buildings. Levy says he's working on such a contract to add to those they have with the Department of Defense. Though Extend's website says it's meant for people with no experience flying drones, it's not cheap.
Very expensive. You know, this camera alone is between $7,000 to $17,000.
Extend is one of nearly 500 international businesses calling Tampa home. The Financial Times report looked at more than 50 reasons in its third annual ranking. Data scientist Jonathan Vincent says there's even a new category this year.
Trade war resilience, because given the sort of scale of disruption to the trading system and the tariffs posed on foreign goods.
Vincent says Tampa imports and exports less than other major cities, and it is
less reliant on global trade and then thus less exposed to disruption.
Extend's Roy Levy says this means his company will need to look for local manufacturers.
I really need to rely as less as possible on those tariffs, right, on imports. The reality is, though, it's going to get the product more expensive.
Tampa Bay Economic Development Council Chair Ron Cristaldi says there's a large variety among the hundreds of international businesses in Tampa. So when one industry is hit hard, another might not be, balancing out the overall impact of tariffs on the city's economy.
It gives us a strength, a resiliency, that if trade with a particular entity in a particular country falters for some reason, or if that country seems to have some economic trouble, we're not as vulnerable to it.
And Extend's U.S. GM Roy Levy says this will help him deal with the rising prices of drone parts he buys from other countries.
This is where we're going to need the administration, the government, the customer to work with us. You know, we want to bring the supply chain here.
Another international company with a new Tampa office is Aquafence.
As you can see, that lifts up the clamp.
Its 4 to 9 foot flood prevention barriers went viral during last year's hurricane season. They can be quickly assembled around a building before a storm to prevent water from getting inside. The Aquafence around Tampa General Hospital held off Hurricane Helene's 7 foot storm surge.
And you'll see here, this pretty little notch here is to catch it and bite it and make sure that it's fully watertight. So this is
in a video demonstration in Naples the company shared with WUSF, an engineer combines the panels, which are manufactured in Norway and Latvia. Chief Revenue Officer Patrick Hansen says tariffs have not affected his company directly yet.
It's a potentially a necessary evil, but at the same time, we're here to do business. We're here to help the community.
Hansen says they hope to move production to Tampa soon to avoid increasing costs from tariffs and to cut down on delivery times for customers.
Maybe the tariffs accelerated that decision a little bit.
He says other factors the Financial Times report considers, like quality of life and business environment, encouraged him to move his family from New Jersey to Tampa to lead Aquafence's new location. I'm Lily Belcher in Tampa.
Florida's unemployment rate held at 3.7% in July, with continuing workforce demand in the state. The unemployment rate also was 3.7% in April, May, and June. A monthly report released today by the Department of Commerce said 417,000 people qualified as unemployed in July. That was out of a total labor force of nearly 11.2 million. Department of Commerce Chief Economist Jimmy Heckman says there continues to be strong demand for workers in the state.
Most people that are out there looking for work can find it. That does lead to a very competitive environment, an environment that really does favor workers in the labor market.
Florida's jobless rate in July of last year was 3.4%. The number of unemployed people increased by 35,000 from last year, while the labor force grew by 25,000. The national unemployment rate in July was 4.2%. That was up from 4.1% a month earlier. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the Mermaid Show at Weekiwachee Springs State Park in Hernando County has been a tourist attraction since the 1940s. Women put on mermaid tails and perform plays underwater while an audience watches in an underground theater. The performers are in a spring, not a pool, so they're fighting the current. Recently, five women who were mermaids in the 1960s relived those days thanks to Wish of a Lifetime from AARP. The mermaids, Arlene, Ruth, Mary Jo, Cheryl, and Donna, are all in their mid to late 70s. WUSF Sky LeBron got to watch them pull their tails back on and hop back in the spring.
How hard is it to put on the tail?
I've got a messed up knee, got messed up stomach, got messed up arm. It's hard.
Okay, now come over here to the ladder.
I can't find the bottom. Where is it that it got to?
How's your tail feeling right now?
It's always good until I get in the water, and then it falls off.
But when they got back in the water, they told me it felt like they were all 19 years old again.
It's like you never left. It's magical. It feels like you're at home again.
Was it easy to get back into the routine? Have you guys done older routines that you did before? Like, what's that all been like?
No routines. We're just trying to see if we remember how to get down, how to hold our breath, how to move the self-buoyancy apparatus that we have attached to our body so we don't float to the top.
How's it been working so far?
So-so.
Is there anything that people think or don't think of when it comes to being a mermaid?
I don't think they realize the endurance that you have to have. Because when we were swimming, we would do 3, 4, 5 shows individually, and the whole show was like up to 7 during the summer.
And we were little then, you know, we were tiny. So we had to fight that current and then stay down for a while.
That core strength had to be on point.
Yeah. These little girls that are swimming now, they're doing an amazing job.
I mean, has there been anything that you've carried through the rest of your lives because of this job and because of this experience?
A lot of pride and a lot of mermaids on our wall.
Got mermaids all over my house. My husband said if I brought another mermaid home, he was going to kill me.
Does that drive to keep on swimming ever stick with you? You ever just want to jump in a lake and be a mermaid again?
No, I live up in the Northwest in Washington State, and it's too dang cold.
I live in Arcadia, Florida, and occasionally I throw my tail on when I'm feeling especially crazy. And I swim around the pool, and everybody comes out and takes a look and says, oh yeah, Arlene's a mermaid. I am.
Does it hit the same?
Nothing's the same when you talk about the water coming up out of the boil. There's just a texture to it. There's a feel to it. There's a lightness. And when you're at my age and at 17, there's really no comparison, but when I get back in that water, it's all there, every last bit of it. I'm weightless, I'm young, I'm pretty, I'm having a good time.
Can I tell you how cool that was? It was pretty humbling to meet people older than me who are way more athletic than I'll ever be. So cool that Wish of a Lifetime from AARP was able to hook them up. Mermaid shows go on all year long. You could find out the details online.
That was WUSF's Sky LeBron reporting. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm, Lily Belcher, and Sky LeBron. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.